Welcome back to the Rehearse on Chumash Parsha Shir on OU Torah. This week, Parshas Lech Lecha, we'll begin our discussion of Rav Hirsch's commentary on the Parsha by taking a look at some of the nisyonos that Avraham Avinu faced when he first came to Eretz Canaan. When Avraham Avinu first shows up in the land, he is immediately faced with a ra'av, with a famine, that strikes Eretz Yisrael, and only Eretz Yisrael, as Chazal tell us, right as soon as he gets there, and is immediately forced to move down to Mitzrayim, and where he has another nisyonos there, where Paro takes Sarah into captivity, and then he's rescued from that Sarah, and then he comes back to Eretz Canaan, and then after the brief interlude in the Parsha about the argument between Avram and Lot, then we see that Avram is faced with war, with Melchama. He is dragged into this war between the four kings and the five kings because they capture Lot, and then he comes to Lot's rescue, and he joins the battle and wins spectacularly thanks to tremendous miracles from Hashem. So you have to look at if we try to put ourselves in Avram Avinu's shoes, when he gets to Eretz Canaan, first, he's hit with famine. Then he encounters war, and this is his impression of this new land which Hashem has promised him, and which Hashem has given him glowing reviews about. And Hashem says, "Zaracho atenes aretz hazos," and this is the wonderful place to which I have shown you, to which I have taken you. And this is Avram's first impressions of the land: famine and war. And Rav Hirsch said this is no mistake. Rav Hirsch writes this in the beginning in his parish, the beginning of Perek Yud Dalet, about the milchama of the Arba Melachim es Hachamisha, the four kings and the versus the five kings. And Rav Hirsch writes that Hashem was sending Avram Avinu a message with these events that happened right when he gets to Eretz Canaan, because he wanted Avram to realize that Eretz Yisrael by its nature does not necessarily provide prosperity materially. It does not provide political independence or peace, because by nature, as we know, Eretz Yisrael is a land that's heavily dependent on rain. And without rain, the land will not prosper. We know also that, as far as politics are concerned, Eretz Yisrael is situated on the crossroads between Europe and Asia. And that's why throughout history, the land has been a focal point for conflict, because the nations converge on this area, in the Middle East, whether they're going from one place to another, or whether they're looking for a foothold to then continue the fight, whether it's to the west or to the east. But whether it was the Romans who were looking to get to Persia and Egypt, or the Greeks, or the Egyptians, or the Babylonians, whoever it might be that was coming through to go from one to the other, always in Eretz Yisrael there was conflict because of that, just by virtue of its location in the Middle East. So Rav Hirsch writes that Avraham Avinu is learning right off the bat that Eretz Yisrael is not intrinsically the best possible land in which a nation can flourish. But the message from Hashem was that if his descendants, the Bnei Yisrael, would keep the Torah and observe the mitzvos that Hashem would give them and follow in the ways of their ancestor Avraham Avinu, then they would have prosperity in this land, despite its natural tendency to not be a place where they would be able to flourish, despite its natural tendencies towards war and famine, perhaps. And so Avram Avinu learns this right away. And the reason why Hashem does this, or first rites, is because this way, when the Jews keep the Torah, and when the Jews succeed, the nations of the world immediately realize that the Jews' success must be due to a higher power. It must be, because no nation that would live in this land would do well for themselves, naturally, if left to the forces of nature. But if they're doing well, it must be because there is a God who is looking out for them. And the Hirsch brings the pasuk in Tehillim, which we say in our Shir Shel Yom, on Monday, we say Elokim ba'ar menoseha noda l'misgav, that through its neighborhoods, Hashem, through its area, Hashem is known as their stronghold, because when there is peace in the land, it can only be because Hashem is looking after the people. If the people keep the Torah, then, as we know, Parshas Bichu Kosai, the brachos, that Hashem promises, v'cherav lo sa'avor ba'artzechem, even a peaceful sword will not come through. Even no passing army will come through, even with no intent to harm the Jewish people. It will just be complete peace. And that could only happen in Eretz Yisrael, in its location, if there is a higher power at work. The same is true of material prosperity and rain, because that's why in the Torah in Sefer Devarim says, Eretz Asher Eini Hashem Elokecha, right, to the land where the eyes of Hashem are constantly turned to it, in the sense that if Hashem was not turning towards the land, then the land would not flourish. The land would not produce produce an abundance of crops and provide for the people what they need. So when Avraham Avinu gets to the land, and he's you can imagine he's expecting something amazing. He's expecting this wonderful land because Hashem is promising to him that his children will get this wonderful land, and this is an amazing promise that Hashem is making to him. But he sees that it's not by nature that this land is great, but it's the potential this land has to be great when his children follow in the ways of Hashem. And this is actually an important message this time of year, as we mentioned, with rain being an important part of Eretz Yisrael's prosperity. And we know that this week, on the 7th of Mar Cheshvan, is when in Eretz Yisrael they begin to say, "V'sein talu matar levracha," and begin to ask for rain. It's now the rainy season in Eretz Yisrael, and we have to understand that we have to earn the rain. We have to earn the rain through our actions. If we keep the Torah, Hashem will give us rain and will protect us. And if not, then we might be in trouble. And we need to recognize that. And this is the message Hashem was sending Avraham Avinu right away upon his entrance to Eretz Canaan. And that's why this land is the chosen land for Bnei Yisrael. Later on in the Parsha, in Perek Tes Vav, Avraham Avinu seems to question Hashem's promise. Hashem has said that your children will be many, and you will have a great nation that descends from you, and I will give them this land. And Avraham Avinu says, "What good is that to me if I don't have any children? And all I have is Damasek Eliezer, my servant Eliezer, who is going to inherit me. But Hashem promises that no, you will have a child, and he will inherit you." But Hashem doesn't just stop there with a verbal promise. And in Perek Tes Vav, Pasuk Hey, we read, "Vayotzei oso hachutza," that Hashem took Avraham Avinu outside, "Vayomer," and he said to him, "Habetno hashamayma," please look towards the heavens, "usfor hakochavim im tuchalus porosam," and count the stars if you are able to do so. "Vayomer lo," and so he said to Avraham, "Koyeh zarecha," so shall your children be. So the verse says, what was the need for Hashem to bring Avraham Avinu outside and show him the stars? Why was this necessary? Hashem promised him, you will have a child. Finish. That should be good enough. Not only that, but earlier in Parak Yud Gimel, Hashem promises Avraham Avinu that your children will be as many as the dust, ka'afar ha'aretz. Also, another symbol for their great numbers. And there, Hashem doesn't take him outside and say, look at the dust. You see, there's so many particles of dust, and your children will be that many as well. But here, when it comes to comparing to the stars, Hashem says, come outside, please look at the heavens, see how many stars there are, try to count them, they're innumerable, and that's how many children you're going to have. So, why was this necessary? What's gained by this illustration through the stars? So, Rehersh says, this is important for us to think about, and because we find symbols throughout Tanakh, especially in the Nevi'im, where the Nevi'im are shown some sort of parable, some sort of sign, and then Hashem interprets the sign for them and tells them what that sign means. And whenever we have a symbol that goes along with a message, Rav Hirsch says that the symbol deepens the message. It gives a broader meaning to the message that might not necessarily have been understood from the words of the message itself. So the symbol, the sign, the picture, whatever it might be, gives a deeper understanding. And here too, Rav Hirsch explains that the deeper understanding that was conveyed by showing Avram the stars that he might not have realized by just the verbal promise of having a child and having many children, many descendants. So Rav Hirsch explains that Avram Avinu had given up all hope of having a child. He at this point, he's an older man. Naturally, he has no reason to expect that he will have a child at this point. So he says to Hashem, I'm not going to have a child. You're telling me I'm going to that I'm going to have this wonderful land. I'm going to have this will be my reward. What good does it do for me? I'm not going to have a child. Naturally speaking, it's impossible. So Hashem said, Habet na shamayma, you have to look at the heavens. Why? He says basically what Hashem is saying is, Avram, you need to change an attitude. And so he shows him the heavens because this the primary difference between the heavens and earth is that on earth, says Rav Hirsch, we no longer see anything created directly by the hand of Hashem. We see things that are the products of the original creations of Hashem, the children of the original people, the original animals, and the next year's growth, which is of course was all started by Hashem's initial creations in Sheshes Mei Bereishis, but we no longer see the initial creations of Hashem Himself in this world. But when you look in the heavens and you see the stars, the planets, the sun and the moon, these are all the exact same things that were created by Hashem at the beginning of creation. And they are still the way they were thousands of years ago is the same way now. We see them exactly the same way. And so Hashem says, look up in the heavens and realize that you're not dealing with the laws of nature as you perceive them. We're dealing with the laws of the laws of creation, basically. We're dealing that Hashem says, I am going to treat you as in the same way I have a relationship with the stars and the sun and the moon, that I created them directly. I am going to be a creator when it comes to you and your descendants, and I'm going to have a direct influence on what happens. And so I will make it happen, even though the laws of nature seem to preclude the fact that Avram will have a child, but Hashem says, I will make sure that it happens. And so Rav Hirsch writes, and I'll quote here from the commentary. Rav Hirsch writes, from the vantage point of Earth, where every effect comes from its given cause, Avram's loss of hope was logical. He would have no rational basis for hoping that he might yet have children. Therefore, God bade him look up toward heaven. There in heaven exists a different world. There we behold the work of creation. There everything was created directly by God. Hence, he who wishes to see a form of existence created directly and without intermediation by God's power should gaze at the stars. He should raise his eyes heavenward and behold there a world that was created directly by God. Can you count the stars? These creations, which originated directly from the Creator's utterance, Yehi, are more numerous than the limited creations of indirect origin on earth. Therefore, tseme itstagninus shelcha, desist from your natural earthbound speculations and open your mind instead to the concept of this starry world. So Rav Hirsch explains that Hashem is telling Avram Avinu, don't think along the lines of nature. Just open up your mind a little bit and realize that things are going to take a supernatural course. Naturally, you will not have children, you're right. But when we forget about the laws of nature and realize that Hashem is directly intervening in Avram's life and in Avram's destiny, then Avram will realize that this promise will indeed happen. And that's the additional dimension of the message that is shared with Avram by telling him to look at the stars. And this is followed by Hashem's commentary, you might say, on the vision of the stars, because Hashem takes him out and shows him the stars, and then Vayomer lo, Hashem says to him, Ko yiyeh zarecha, so shall your children be. And we normally understand this to mean your children will be as numerous as the stars. But Rav Hirsch says it's more than that. It's more than that. Because Ko yiyeh zarecha doesn't just explain the quantity of the children, but also the quality and the nature of their relationship with Hashem. Ko yiyeh zarecha means your children will be like the stars in that they will be created directly from Hashem. They will illustrate the Etzba Elokim in their very existence. So it's also on the manner of Hashem's relationship to the stars. Ko yezarecha, Hashem will have a similar relationship to the Bnei Yisrael. And Rav Hirsch says that we read similarly in Tehillim, in Parak Kuf Mem Zayin, which we say in Pesukei Dezimra every day. And there we read, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem Nidchei Yisrael Yichanes. Hashem is the builder of Yerushalayim, and he gathers those who are dispersed of Klal Yisrael. Horofei L'Shvurei Lev Umchabesh La'atzvosam. He heals their broken hearts, the broken-hearted ones, and binds up their wounds. Monem is par lakochavim lichulam shemos yikra. He counts the numbers of the stars, and he calls them all by name. Gadol adoneinu v'rav koach v'lisvuna so ein mispor. Great is our God, surpassing in power. His wisdom is beyond all reckoning. And so we see here a connection between Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes and Rofei l'shvurei lev mechabesh la'atzvosam, Hashem's direct relationship, his personal relationship with every member of Klal Yisrael. And we compare that to Monem Mispar Lakochavim L'chulam Shemos Yikra. And when we put that together, we recognize that Gadol Adoneinu V'rav Koach L'svuna So Ein Mispar. Because we understand now that because Hashem is a personal relationship with us, Hashem is our creator and not just our God. Hashem has a direct intervention in our that is this the source of our very existence. So even if we are nidche Yisrael, we are in galus, we are pushed aside, we are in a terrible state, but if we remember that Hashem is monem is par lakochavim, we understand that Hashem is looking down on us with hashgacha pratis and taking care of us, each of us as individuals. And Rav Hirsch references the famous Mishnah in Avos, where the Mishnah in the sixth parak of Avos, it's really Braisa, cites the pasuk that about the luchos, that the writing was chorus al haluchos, it was engraved on the luchos, and the Mishnah says that you should read it as chorus, that you don't read the word chorus, engraved, read chorus, freedom. Because ein l'cha ben chorin el misha osik b'torah, that one who is involved in Torah, one who lives a life of Torah, is the epitome of freedom, in the sense that he's free from the laws of nature. And that if a person is chorus al haluchos, he becomes a ben chorin, freed from the chains that nature places on everything in the world, and the limits that of nature, and Hashem lifts him up above that. And allows us as ben chorin, because we are osek b'Torah, Hashem allows us to survive and continue to exist, even though it's really not naturally feasible. And Rav Hirsch also repeats this point later on in the parsha, when Hashem promises the birth of Yitzchak. And Rav Hirsch comments on the origin of the name Yitzchak. And this is not a uniquely Hirschian explanation per se, but it goes together with this understanding of the stars and this understanding of Koyi Zarecha, because we see in Perek Yud Zayin when Hashem promises you're going to have a son again, and so we read in Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayipol Avraham al panav vayitzchak. Avraham falls on his face and he laughs. And so first explains what is laughter? That we laugh when something we see something incongruous or something that's silly and absurd. And so Avraham was laughing because the fact that Hashem was promising him a child and the fact that he would have a child at the age of 100 and for Sarah to have a child at the age of 90 was ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous. It's impossible, it's unnatural, and it's downright absurd. And to even further than that, Rav Hirsch says, so now, even if he does have a child at age 100, now this child is going to be an only child to his mother. He's going to be orphaned at a young age because, obviously, his parents are really old. So how would he then go on to be the father of a great nation with such an upbringing? So that's why Avram can't help but laugh at how ridiculous the whole situation seems. But Rav Hirsch explains that Hashem takes Avram's laughter at the absurd situation that he is seeing, And he says, this laughter, that's the child's name. That's the essence of this child and his nation that will all descend from him. The name Yitzhak, laughter, is because the entire existence of Klal Yisrael, from a natural perspective, is ridiculous and absurd. It makes no sense whatsoever. The fact that a small nation that has spent most of its time with no homeland, that's in Golus, and has no connection to one another, and is dispersed four corners of the earth, and is weak, and is unable to stand up for itself, and is constantly attacked from all sides, but to somehow to continue to survive, to somehow to continue to exist these thousands of years later, despite all that has befallen them in all these long years of exile, it's ridiculous. It doesn't make sense. It's unnatural. But that's who we are. We are a nation at which people laugh at the ridiculousness of our existence, the beginning of our nation's existence through the birth of Yitzchak, and our continued existence through all these years doesn't make any sense if you consider nature. But it's the intervention and the direct guidance of Hashem in our lives and the existence of our nation through all these thousands of years. That is what we owe our existence to. And the laughter makes us realize that, and makes the world at large realize that that Hashem is intervening in the fate and destiny of Klal Yisrael, and they recognize, hopefully, that there is something more to us, and there is something important, something great to us and to about us and about the Torah that we are devoted to, and about Hashem to whom we are committed. So, and Rav Hirsch says beyond that, he says that Hashem intentionally waited until Avram was 100 years old so that he should have a child. And because he wanted to show that the existence of Klal Yisrael is due only to Hashem. And that people should then recognize Hashem through us, not only through what we do and our Torah and our mitzvot and our religion and the way our way of life, but just through our very existence. Nations of the world should just stop and think and realize, how could it be that a Klal Yisrael exists today if not for Ribono Shel Olam? How could it be? It can't. It's impossible. And that's why Hashem waited until age 100 for Avram to have a child, so that this name Yitzchak, this feeling, this Avram's laughter, should be immortalized through the name Yitzchak and throughout our thousands of years. That everyone should recognize the Etzba Elokim through our nation's existence from its very beginning, from the birth of Yitzchak, Ad Hayom Hazeh, to this very day. And in fact, there's a quote from Mark Twain where he says that there's really no way to explain the existence of the Jewish people today. And that's the idea, that through our very existence, the nations of the world should recognize that there is a God in this world. There is a creator. And then hopefully they will come to learn of him and will learn how to serve him and learn what he wants of everybody in his world. I'd like to take some time and focus on how Rav Hirsch goes about explaining the mitzvah of Bris Milah, which Rav Hirsch himself says in the Perush on Chumash. He writes that he treats this at greater length in the essay, which is now printed in the third volume of the collected writings. But he deals with, there's plenty of pages here in the Chumash to go through where he endeavors to explain what the meaning of Mila is. And I will try to cover some of it in brief, but again, I highly recommend reading through the Perush in the Chumash, and if time permits, to look at the third volume of the collected writings, where Rav Hirsch deals with Mila at great length. So the mitzvah of Mila begins in the beginning of Parak Yud Zayin, where Hashem appears to Avram and introduces the parasha of Mila by saying, Ani Kel Shakai, Hishalech Lefonai Vayesamim. He said, I am Kel Shakai. This is the name he introduces himself with. And this is the first time the name Shakai appears in the Torah. And he says, walk before me and be tamim, be complete. And so Rav Hirsch explains how this introductory statement encapsulates the whole meaning of Bris Milah. Because he explains what's the meaning of the name Shakai. So he quotes a Mamar Chazal that explains what the meaning of this name. The root of the name is Dai, which means enough. So Chazal say, "Anihu she'amarti le'olami v'la'shamayim dai v'la'aretz dai." I am He who said to my, I said to my world and to the heavens, enough, and to the earth, enough. She'il mole she'amarti lahem dai. Had I not said enough to the world, ad achshav hayu nimtachim v'hochim, they would still be expanding and developing to this very day. So the Hashem's command of dai to the world means that when Hashem initially began creation at the very beginning of the world, Hashem didn't just create, Hashem also stopped creation in its tracks. Hashem said, die, enough, this is all we need, this is what the world should look like. Hashem reigned in all the forces of creation, and that's Shabbos. Shabbos is when Hashem created rest, in the sense that Hashem created this cessation of work by reigning in all the forces of the creation and saying die. That is the name Shakai. And so Hashem introduces the mitzvah Milu with Shakai because Rav Hirsch explains that Hishalech Lefanai Ve'yei Samim is saying, follow me and be complete. And he explains how Tamim is the human version of Hashem's Dai. Because Hashem's statement of Dai means that Hashem restrains the creative power. Hashem sets limits for the world. And it's important to recognize Hashem as a creator who said Dai, because there are obviously misconceptions of how the world came into being. There are those who say there is no creator, it's just nature. And even there are those who say there is a creator, and the creator set creation in motion and then took a back seat. But Rav Hirsch says that the description of Hashem as Shakai, of the one who said Dai, refutes these understandings of the creation of the world. Because if not for a creator who says Dai, the world would never stop creating. If you say that the world is just the forces of nature at work, well, then why is the world not still creating new things, and the world not still expanding further and further? And the same, if you say that there is a creator, but he just flipped the switch and never turned it off, why would we not be seeing new creations until today? And that's what Chazal are saying was accomplished by Hashem's statement of Dai. And Rav Hirsch actually says that the name Shakai teaches us not to identify the Borei Olam or think of the Borei Olam as a sorcerer's apprentice who forgot the spell to control the magic that he had set loose, and that no, Hashem was able to create, and that Hashem also intervened and stopped creation and set limits. So now Hashem asks us to emulate Him in this sense, and we emulate Him by being Tamim. What does Tamim mean? So Rav Hirsch explains that Tamim, which is often translated as perfect, but that's really, when you translate Tamim as perfect, that's approaching it from a positive point of view, meaning that you've accomplished all that you could possibly accomplish. Rav Hirsch says that Tamim can also be approached from a negative point of view, in the sense that it means going up to the limit, but not stepping any further. Tamim means to be complete, in the sense of using everything at one's disposal, taking full advantage of everything that a person has up to the limit that has been set on it, and then not stepping past that one iota. So Rav Hirsch explains, Tamim means not to say, I'm avoiding, we discussed this a little bit in Parshas Bereishis, but not to completely avoid a person's physical aspects and a person's natural drives, but to utilize them to their fullest within the limits that Hashem has imposed. And that is Tamim. So when we allow ourselves to be creative, to be human, to be productive, and to act as human beings, but then we also say die to ourselves and rein in those tendencies and those temptations and tell them to stop where we know that it is forbidden to go further, and then we are emulating Hashem as Shakai. So just to read a little bit in the commentary of Rav Hirsch, Rav Hirsch writes, the attribute of Tamimus in the human character is analogous to the divine attribute of Shakai. None of the created things, except for man, can go beyond their given sphere. Since God has called out to them, die, they cannot overstep their bounds. The Jew, however, is told, of your own free will, say die to yourself. Where God told you die, say die to yourself. That is the whole essence of Judaism. The whole Torah is none other than the call die uttered by God to man. Sin is termed avera, literally an overstepping, because a person does not sin unless he oversteps the divinely set limits. All human aspirations, including physical desires, are holy and pure, provided that they do not violate the limits set by God. No human quality is good or bad in and of itself. The Torah's prohibitions do not call for the suppression or stifling of any feature of our lives. Rather, they assign each feature its own clearly defined area for its development. Only when these limits are overstepped, and generally also when they are not attained, does a human act become a sin. This is the basic character of lawfulness as Judaism sees it. Hishalich lefanai v'yei samim. Conduct yourself freely within the limits set by God. So this is how Rav Hirsch explains Hishalich lefanai v'yei samim. It's emulating Hashem as Shakai. It's being ourselves, in a sense, using everything at our disposal and acting on our human tendencies, needs, our physical aspects, but up until the limit. And then we say die to ourselves. And that is where we exercise our bechira to put our mind, our ahead of our body, to control ourselves. And when we impose the self-control over ourselves, we are being like Hashem. We are being like Hashem in his essence of Shakai. So with this introduction that Hashem gives, then Hashem says, "V'etznabri si beinu veinecha." I'm going to place my covenant between me and you. I will multiply you greatly. And Rav Hirsch explains that this bris is beinu veinecha. It's a two-way street. It's between me and between you. It's a mutual bris. The bris is, and the bris is the covenant between Hashem and us, where Hashem says, "You be tamim towards me, and I will arbeos chavim od me'od. I will multiply you greatly. I will make you into a great nation. I will direct, as we've been discussing up till now this year, I will intervene in the existence of Klal Yisrael and watch out for them and make sure that they succeed, provided that you are hishalech lefanai v'yesamim, that you are act b'tmimus, you act with self-control, that you subordinate all of your actions to the limits that Hashem imposes on Bnei Israel through Torah and mitzvos. So that is the bris. Now, on top of the bris, there is an os bris, a sign of the covenant. Just like last week in Parashas Noach, there's a covenant Hashem makes with Noach that Hashem says, "I will never bring another mabul," and the sign of the covenant, the symbol which shows that there is a covenant, is the rainbow. So here too we have a bris and an os bris as well. The bris is, you be tamim, I will as a result then, arbe os chamim od me'od, I will take care of you. And the os, the symbol, the sign of that bris, is the mila. And why is the mila the os of the bris? Mila is the os because through the act of Mila, we show that we are subordinating our body to our minds. We are subordinating our body to what Hashem wants of us. And we symbolize all these ideas of Hishalech lefanai v'yesamim, to emulate Hashem as Shakai. It's all symbolized in the act of the Mila. And Rav Hirsch points out that Mila means to limit. Mila means to limit, and it's Mila, not Krisa, right? Koreis, to cut off entirely. Because we are merely limiting ourselves, but not eliminating our abilities to act as within our physical spheres as well. When we through the Mila, we express the idea that we become complete both positively and negatively, meaning we actualize the fullest of our potential, but then we limit that as well. We observe the limits while still utilizing everything at our disposal within the limits imposed on us. So it's both the positive, so trying to symbolize the positive and negative meanings of the of tamimus. And with this mila, we symbolize that by merely limiting and not completely cutting off, because we act within the limits set by Hashem. Now, Rav Hirsch also points out that the mila itself is referred to in pasuk yud as the bris itself. It's pasuk says zos brisi asher tishmeru. This is the covenant that you should keep between me and you, between with your children after you. Himo lochem kol zachar. The circumcision itself, the mila itself, is the bris. Zos brisi asher tishmeru. This is the bris itself. But then the next pasuk says unmaltem es besar or laschem, that you should circumcise the foreskin. And that is the sign of the covenant between me and you. So how can it be both the bris and the os bris? So Rav Hirsch explains that this is the nature of a symbol. And this is where the third volume of collected writings would be a resource, where Rav Hirsch goes through a few examples of symbols and has a whole essay about how symbolism works. But in short, he says here that, let me read the commentary and explain afterwards. So Rav Hirsch writes, in symbolic mitzvos, we are commanded by God not only to be mindful of the idea that is symbolized, but also, and indeed primarily, to perform the mitzvah act. Recollection of the idea can never substitute for the performance of the act. Failure to perform the act is tantamount to denying the idea. He who fails to make the sign of the covenant breaks the covenant itself. The making of the sign itself is called keeping the covenant, shmiras habris. On the other hand, the performance of the act accomplishes its full purpose only if it becomes an os, a symbol. Only if it is taken to heart as a symbol, and if the idea symbolized by the act comes alive within us. Nonetheless, the performance of the act is the primary fulfillment of the mitzvah. By performing the act, we give expression to the idea as an utterance of God forever. Through the act, we recall and preserve the idea as an utterance of God that lives forever. In other words, what Rav Hirsch says is that the sign is important, because the sign leaves an impression on our bodies, at least in this case, especially where the sign leaves an impression on our bodies. But in general, the os reminds us of the meaning of the bris. And when we see the mila on our bodies, we understand that we must be tamim in all aspects of our behavior. And so when we keep the bris, when we do the mila, that's as if we're keeping the bris itself, because it's a way, it ensures that the bris is passed on from generation to generation. And even though, as Rav Hirsch writes later on, that the mila is performed on the child out his awareness, but because it's inscribed on his body, it's signed for him forever, constantly, and reminds him of his connection with Hashem and his obligations to serve Hashem to the fullest within those divinely imposed limits. But Rav Hirsch says it's not enough, because then one might say, well, instead of just doing a mila, I'll remember these ideas, I'll talk about them, I'll read something about them, I'll contemplate them, and that should be sufficient. Rav Hirsch says no, that's not enough, right? You have to do the mila itself. That's why the mila itself is the bris. But it still remains os bris. It remains os bris because it's not the be-all and the end-all. Because the opposite misconception of saying that I'll contemplate the idea is to say that I'll do the mila, and I won't think about what I'm doing at all, and I've done the bris mila, and finished. That's all. I don't have to think of what it means. I don't have to know why I'm doing the bris mila. It's sufficient to just do the act of the bris mila, and I've performed the mitzvah. And while it's true that the act of mila is the mitzvah in this case, but it's meant to be an os, a symbol, a reminder of the deeper message it's meant to convey, the message of hishalech lefanai ve'yei samim. So there's a medium between saying contemplating ideas and doing this action blindly without thinking about what it means. Instead, we're supposed to do the the action, the physical expression of the ideas of the Mila, but also recognize that we must think further and use the Mila as a springboard to further contemplation of the ideas and to remind us to be tamim at all times. And this is true of all symbols. And again, like I said, in the third volume of Collected Writings, you can see how Rav Hirsch treats all the other symbols that he discusses there. And you see them throughout Torah. Many of the mitzvahs we do are really symbolic in nature. We physically perform these symbolic acts, but then we use them as a springboard to contemplate the meanings that they represent. And in this case, it's Hisalech Lefanai Vayei Samim, that we want the Mila to remind us that we should be limiting ourselves of our own Bechira, as Rav Hirsch wrote and as we read earlier, unlike the rest of creation where Hashem said, die to it, and that's it. Everything is subject to the word of Hashem. Hashem does not say, die to human beings. We must say, die to ourselves. And there's a passage in the beginning of the Orchos Tzadikim where in Hakdama, it says that the measure of a tzaddik is chachmaso yimshol al tavaso, that his wisdom rules over his desires. And that's the essence of what Hashem wants of us. That's the essence of hisalich lefanai ve'yei samim, to put our minds ahead of our bodies, to have a little bit of self-control, and to remember at all times that there are limits imposed by Hashem, not to our detriment. That's why Rav Hirsch wrote in the beginning, and I read that earlier, where Hashem imposed limits on us because Hashem gave us the ability to use all of our desires in the best possible, in a way that's appropriate for us. Right? Rav Hirsch wrote that Torah's prohibition assigned each feature its own clearly defined area for its development. Each aspect of our being is given free rein as much as it needs. And then Hashem imposed limits where it would go too far, where in the case of Mila, we might say, where the physical desires would then devolve into licentiousness and lust and be used improperly. So Hashem limits it to the point where these physical aspects would be used for positive purposes. So we see here just a little taste of how Rav Hirsch approaches symbolic mitzvos, and how it relates to Mila itself, and the difference between the bris and the os bris, and how they interact with one another.